This Week in Retronauts, it's Human Instrumentality from Texas. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Retronauts Micro. I don't know. It was like an Evangelion reference.
I mean, I got
the
that,
human instrumentality. I don't know. Texas Instruments. I don't know.
Okay.
It's kind of a stretch.
It's been a long afternoon. Hi, everyone. It's Jeremy Parrish with Retronauts Micro. And you're hearing the voices of...
Benj Edwards.
Ben Elgin.
And also me, Jeremy Parrish. But I mentioned that already. Mm-hmm. So today we are going to kind of revisit the original Retronauts Micro topic. When I kicked off this series back in, I don't know, 2014-ish, 2015? I can't remember. A long time ago. The very first topic I covered was Texas Instruments TI-99/4A computer. But that was me monologuing for like 7 minutes, which is not nearly as interesting or informative as a full conversation about the system. So I've invited two guys who know a lot about the system and its games to come in and talk about it with me. And this is going to be sort of a like a companion piece to Retronauts Micro Episode 1, but much, much better. I think this is Episode 61 or so. So it's been a while. We've done a bunch. So I think it's fair to revisit a topic that was kind of covered in brief before and do it justice. So that's what this episode's going to be. I think I mentioned I mentioned in the micro episode before that I did not own a Texas Instruments computer, but because I lived in Lubbock, Texas, where TI had its plant and manufactured the TI-99/4A, those things were everywhere. Like every other school system in America had Apple IIs, but TI was like, no, Lubbock Independent School District, you put TIs in your classroom. And they said, okay. So that's what we had. Of course, then the system, you know, ended up being sold for like $49 because of price competition. And yeah, it went badly. So at that point, it was super cheap and everyone could own one.
Yeah. So I had one at home and I have a feeling it was probably after the price dropped a lot. My parents bought, I actually asked my parents if they remembered why we bought this particular one as opposed to any of the competing, you know, Commodores or Amigas or whatever. And they had no idea. I was in the Midwest, but not Texas, up in St. Louis. But it was probably after the price dropped and it was affordable. And this was actually the first computer, that I had that was mostly mine. And it was before, you know, I had an NES. So this was where I had games and computer stuff when I was small.
Mm-hmm. I think the TI-99/4A was one of the first machines I got as a collector, in the early 90s when I was still a kid, but my dad bought me one at a ham fest, you know, a secondhand model. And I came from a Atari 800 sort of school of thought. And the TI was incredible, like the solid state software cartridges you push in there. I mean, they're like any other cartridge, but I love the fact that you push them in horizontally and they just work.
Yeah, it was really different. And computers based on cartridges were pretty uncommon. The MSX did that, but yeah. I can't think of any others.
It was in this hybrid space between personal computers and consoles, although consoles weren't really a thing yet.
Yeah, I mean, but I guess some of the Atari computers.
Yeah, you had Ataris.
Commodores. They're all based on cartridges.
Yeah, you had Ataris and Commodores.
I always thought it was Commodore as like a diskette-based thing.
But yeah, so it was this hybrid where it had aspects of a personal computer. You could program on it. But it also had these cartridges that were just standalone games, but it also had, you could add all kinds of wacky peripherals to it, including like the audio cassette. You could record your programs to audio cassette, which was just kind of weird, but great. And there were a whole bunch of other peripherals you could put into it. You could expand it with like voice synthesis. That was the cool one.
Yeah, we should step back for a second and think about the precursor to the 4A, which was the 4, the TI-99-4, right?
Before we do that, I think we should just talk about TI and kind of how they got into
really step back.
Yeah, I think it's important to give the context. So Texas Instruments, you probably know them from their calculators because they still make them, and they're kind of the standard for graphing calculators and so on and so forth. Back in the 70s, though, TI didn't just make calculators. They also made mini computers. Mini computers aren't something that really exist anymore. But this was back in the days when the microcomputer, which is what we think of as computers now, was still kind of this pie in the sky concept. I mean, they started developing the TI-99-4, the system that eventually became the 99, in like 1976. So it was kind of contemporaneous with the Apple I. So basically, TI had two different schools of microprocessors that they developed. This was in the days when it wasn't just Intel and ARM and Motorola making chips. It was everybody. Everyone was making their own semiconductors. So TI had, you know, their calculator chips, but then they also had their 16-bit processor for their mini computers. And they said, let's get into the microcomputer market and make an 8-bit chip. And they failed. They did not make an 8-bit chip. They made a 16-bit chip and said, well, let's just put this in our computer.
Oh, I remember now. Yeah, their microprocessor, that TMS, what was it?
9900.
Yeah, it was just a single chip version of their CPU board from one of their mainframe computers.
Yeah, they just put it all on the chip. Yeah.
So they accidentally, sort of inadvertently in 1980, created the world's most powerful home computer. But not really. It was a 16-bit system because they couldn't get their 8-bit chip to work or whatever. They couldn't get the yields up. I don't know what it was. But they kind of hamstrung it. Like, even though it had this 16-bit processor, like, the bus was 8-bit. And it just, like, the system couldn't take advantage of everything. But, yeah, it started out as kind of a mess. You wanted to talk about the TI-99-4 and go for it. Because it was like a...
Well,
it was a big mess, honestly.
The chiclet keyboard is the biggest mess part of it.
No, I'd say the fact that it cost $1,100.
Well, I read it was more.
It was $1,100.
It came with a monitor, and
it had to come with a monitor because of the mess. They couldn't get get FCC approval on their connector, so they could only use a specific kind of monitor. You couldn't use it with any TV like you could a lot of other computers. So it had to come with a specific Zenith monitor. And yeah, that raised the price. There's the chiclet keyboard. Go ahead and talk about that because that's gross.
Well, it's just a crappy little keyboard that it's not like a full touch typing where you push it down and you feel it. It's kind of like that Mac he's got in his lap. Chiclet.
No,
but that has more action to
it. Yeah, I mean,
it's more of like pushing on wet, soggy grapes.
Yeah, chiclet keyboards were
squishy eyeballs.
Apple has managed to give some decent scissor action to their tiny keyboards that was not present in a chiclet keyboard from long ago.
But the whole thing seems like they tried to take this like more powerful business computer and just kind of smoosh it down into a home system, and it really didn't work the first time through. Mm-hmm. Like it just everything was compromised, but still expensive.
Yeah, I mean it was more expensive than an Apple II, but much less powerful. Much less pleasing to use. Mm-hmm. It was not good. So that was 1980, I want to say. 1979? Maybe?
Yeah, I think 79.
Yeah, and it was a huge flop.
Okay. I did an article called Design Mistakes. 15 Classic PC Design Mistakes in 2009 for Technologizer. And I was thinking, I know I've written about the TI-99 somewhere. Like the original 99.
The 99-4.
Yeah. 99/4, yeah.
Why was it called the 4?
It's because like, they only made four of them.
Oh, okay.
That
makes sense. I know it's 99 because its chip was the TMS-9900.
Yeah.
And the 4A was because the digital video display processor, like its serial number ended with an A. But I don't know about the 4. I couldn't find that anywhere.
Yeah. I mean, no one had them because they were terrible.
Yeah. showed him. Let me look up
whatever. Anyways, the original phone was bad. That's the takeaway. So they made a different one, and then it got
better. The keyboard sucked. It was too expensive. Yeah, and it had some other problems. I don't remember. Something about the power supply or the RF something.
So the 4A was a revision, and they fixed some things, and they made it a lot cheaper, and it suddenly became competitive.
Yeah, the 4A was $81. So that was
they cut the price in half. Yeah. They gave you a better keyboard, like a nice chunky keyboard with big old thick keys and felt good when you pressed them.
It's perfectly good.
I think they allowed you to use different kinds of monitors. They finally got the shield.
Ours was plugged into our TV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they also they gave you like the daisy chain serial expansion, which I don't think was in the 4, was it?
It was in the 4. Yeah, I have a picture of it all sitting in there. That was one of the weirdest, quirkiest things about the sidecar expansion.
You could just keep adding things,
daisy chaining, okay, that's normal. Like, everyone does daisy chaining, but...
So if you want a full system, you end up with something that's like 5 feet wide. You have to stick in a speech synthesizer. There's even a printer that's stuck in the side, a 32K RAM expansion... serial port thing, a disk controller and a disk drive, and
so imagine that tower meme that goes around with the Mega Drive and the 32X and yada yada stacked up about 5 feet tall, and just turn it on its side, and then you've got the TI with all its expansions.
Yeah, it's really weird because they did daisy chaining, but instead of using cables to connect everything, each component just plugged into the other one. So you have sideways. like the keyboard and then like 5 or 6 things, and it became impractical for the desktop.
Hope you've got a long desk.
Yeah. One of the nice things that they did with the 99.4A after like a year or so was create the
peripheral expansion box.
Yep, pub.
Pib. Yeah.
Pib. Pib. That's it.
Pib.
Which was it kind of made the 99.4A look more like what you think of these days as like a classic computer. You know, the processor was in the keyboard, like that was the computer, but then you had the Pib. And you put the monitor on top of that. And the PEB was a large, I think, aluminum box. It was very durable. Mm-hmm. But you basically could slot everything into there, and it would be discreet and tucked away. And it, like the serial bus in there was adjustable and would kind of automatically modify itself to...
I don't know anything about that, but
was using.
It's a hefty, hefty thing.
It's a big old chunk of things.
It's like heavy. It's got a big power supply. It's got... a spot for a disk drive in it, and it was much more efficient than
having your entire desk this sprawling mess of connected peripherals.
On ours, we didn't even have that. We just had the base system, and then we had it plugged into our old CRT TV, because you could just get a CRT adapter for it.
Yeah, when I think of the TI-99/4A, I think of the keyboard with the speech synthesizer module plugged into the side, and then the peripheral expansion box behind it with a monitor on top. That was sort of the ideal way to use the TI-99/4A.
Yeah, but most people probably used it with a cassette drive. And
we had a cassette drive.
The expense involved.
It was the cheapest stuff.
So we should talk just for a minute about one of the reasons that the 99.4A seemed so sluggish was the fact that its BASIC was written in an interpreted language called GPL, Graphics Programming Language.
Well, no wonder.
So the interpreted language of BASIC, if you write a program in BASIC, it's running on top of another interpreted language that's being interpreted.
I did not know that.
Yep.
No wonder it's
super duper slowish. Even though it's a 16-bit. Yeah.
But despite some of its quirks, it was an extremely expandable system. One of the interesting things that, in researching this episode, I found is that TI was working on something that kind of functioned like USB, back in the early 80s, where it was like a plug-and-play, hot-swappable interface. Hmm. They never got it working, but there is a certain sort of fan community and developer community that still exists for the TI-99/4A, and people have actually... brought USB to the system.
Nice.
So you can use this modern interface standard within the 99.4A, which I don't know what you would do with that, but it's there and the option exists.
There's a new video replacement chip thing going on too that gives it more colors and stuff that hobbyists are doing. I forgot what it's called. But
you can find.
I mean, I'm sure you could just, you know, USB drive for your basic programs, but I'm not sure what else. Not sure what else you get into it.
Somebody made an interface for the Atari 800, a USB interface too, and it's just sort of for the heck of it.
Yeah, it's just like it's the Mount Everest thing. Yeah. It's there, so you got to do it.
Speaking about it,
no. But yeah, so TI made an interesting computer with some flaws and some good traits. One of the cool things about it was the speech synthesizer module that I touched on, which had really good computer generated speech.
Do you know why?
Why?
Speak and spell. Really? They invented the speak and spell.
That's right. I interviewed one of the engineers. That's where the speech synthesis came from, was the speak and spell module.
The speak and spell chip. So I interviewed one of the engineers who created speak and spell. Unfortunately, I forgot his name, but you can find it on vintagecomputing.com. And TI did that project, and it simulated a human vocal tract in electronics. It was really crazy and advanced for its time. And so they had that technology around, so they put it in a box.
Yeah, like this wasn't samples like you would do today. This was actually like just taking raw waveforms and manipulating them until you got stuff that was recognizable.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, it comes in a really it works in a really weird kind of way.
Little box that you see. Anytime you see a TI-99/4A, you almost always see that little box plugged into the computer. The
right side of it.
Yeah, it's like almost an oversized mouse, except it's not. It's the speech synthesizer.
So I don't actually have the speech synthesizer, but
what?
I do have...
You're the one person.
I know, but I do have the TI-99/4A, and I do have a speak and spell. Can I have these two
of them
together?
If you want one, I've got two.
I'm going to plug my speak and spell into the TI and see what happens.
Sure, you might accidentally phone ET's home planet.
That's true.
UFO's going to show up.
Oh, we came for you, buddy.
You want to play TI Invaders?
So games?
Yeah, so...
that killed everything.
Games. Yeah, the weird thing about the TI is that Texas Instruments did not allow licensing, per se. They did not... They were super strict about things. They wanted... Like, if someone wanted to publish on TI, they needed to do it through TI. Kind of like Nintendo wants to do.
Even more so, but yeah.
But the thing is, Nintendo didn't really bring that licensing program into existence until they had a pretty good lock on the Japanese market. TI did not have a lock on the American market, and there were a lot of competing computer standards. And so third parties said, no thanks. We'll go with other companies. And so no games that you recognized showed up on TI.
Unless you count a lot of homebrew knockoffs.
Later, Atari soft ports.
Later on there were actual ports.
Or one, maybe.
But in the early years... Defender, something. In the early years, Sega. It was all like rewritten knockoffs.
There were some Sega cartridges.
Were there?
Yeah. They towards even the come end. In a Sega cartridge style.
I didn't have any of those, but if you search some Congo stuff Bongo. Shows up towards the end of its lifespan where there were actual
other things. Congo Bongo was on there?
Yeah.
I saw that.
Bongo's on everything.
I saw that on there. But that was much later.
I have that cartridge.
The first few years, it was all TI's in-house stuff.
And like Frogger or something. They were probably rare, and it was probably the later 80s, kind of.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why don't we talk about the games that did come out when, you know, in the heyday, the 2 year period where this was a viable system.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Pretty much all of them were made by TI. Some of them were original. Some of them were adaptations of classic concepts. And some of them were just straight up ripoffs of popular arcade games. That's pretty much the three categories of TI games.
Yep.
So, I've got a list here that I put together, and I see that you guys have added to it. So why don't we just go for it?
Sure.
Well, what's the
coolest game? Do we want to start with the straight up riff offs and move up to the more interesting?
Yeah, let's
things?
Talk about the riff offs.
So, rip-offs. Like we had Munchman. Guess Munch what? Man. That was a rip off of
Munch Invaders, right?
So it's basically it's inverse Pac-Man, where instead of
Pac-Man meets Light Cycles.
Yeah. So instead of eating dots, you're laying down a trail.
Mm-hmm. What are you munching, though?
It's kind of like Poop Man, if you think about it.
He still does this munching Poop action man, for no gross. Reason other than it's a ripoff of Pac-Man. But as far as I know.
So it's not munching
It's a ripoff
at all.
Of Pac-Man and Casey Munchkin. Yeah. It's a double ripoff.
Yeah. Don't bring up Casey Munchkin, man.
But yeah, you're laying down trails, and other than that, it's exactly Pac-Man. And then you have TI Invaders, which is a straight-up Space Invaders.
It was good.
It was good. It was fine.
It's fun to play with the keyboard.
Yeah, but I mean, everyone made a Space Invaders clone. If you couldn't make a good Space Invaders clone, they needed to take you out back.
The joysticks, I should point out, the joysticks on the TI sucked ass. I mean, they were horrible. They're like mudgy, pludgy little. It's like playing.
It's like a stick with a big wide button.
One big red button.
And neither,
and a stick.
You know, it's into one plug. Two controllers plugged into one thing that goes in the back. So you could have two, but they just were horrible. I mean, they just would break and
they were not good.
And you didn't. It felt like, you know, like stirring frozen ice cream. That's a good analogy.
And like I said,
trying to
both of them with fairly short cables into a single plug. So basically, two of you sitting on the floor right in front of the system is the only way you're going to.
It was the Wendy's Frosty controller, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The button
that sounds more appealing
than
it actually was.
You can't eat it, though. That's the problem.
They were pretty bad.
Dip a French fry.
So a lot of games are controlled with the keyboard by necessity. Because either you didn't have the joysticks, or the joysticks broke, or they were just
I had the joysticks, but I think I resorted to the keyboard for some of them.
Yeah, I do remember a friend of mine who lived on the same block of me had a TI and had the joysticks, which we didn't have at the computers at school, and I did not enjoy using the joysticks.
Yeah. Nobody I know. I have like five pairs of those joysticks. I've never really used them because they're just terrible.
I mean, now in fairness, some of the Atari joysticks were pretty bad, too. I mean,
they work,
good one, but
I mean, they work.
Depending on which,
except
brand
the 5200.
Those weren't good.
Anyways,
but
so were there any other ripoff games on TI?
I mean,
I'm sure there were.
There were a lot of adaptations, like Hunt the Wumpus and things.
Yeah, that's a separate category though. But yeah. Hunt the Wumpus is one of the great games of the TI, I would say.
Yeah, it was cool.
A classic graphic or text
adaptation
adventure
of the mainframe game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It ends up playing kind of like Minesweeper, in my opinion, because you're sort of you've got a sort of grid-based system, and you're playing off clues about what are in the adjacent grid tiles around you to avoid the Wumpus, and then you have to figure out based on the clues of the wind and the bats and whatever of where to shoot your arrow to kill the Wumpus eventually while avoiding him and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, each round takes like a minute, but
it's neat.
You know, it's challenging because you have to kind of infer through clues where the Wumpus is and try to avoid it killing you.
Yeah, it's like working off imperfect information kind of game as you explore and try to make your best guess.
And you're not going through a maze so much as like a kind of a grid that's got irregular connections.
Yeah.
And you're sort of figuring out the connections as you go.
It's a grid, but it's some of them are connected directly
some of them
and then some
around.
Of them are bent.
Yeah, I remember that.
Bent paths between diagonal grid faces. Yeah.
That's a good game.
And then at the very end, when you figure out where the Wumpus is, you let your arrow fly.
Mm-hmm.
Just like when you're fighting Ganon.
Hope you got it right. Actually, there's another one I should have talked about where we're doing ones that are mostly just ripoffs is Video Games 1, which I think came with the system in a lot of the bundles.
Oh, yeah?
Which was just a cartridge that had three different games on it, and they were all super simple. They were kind of okay. One of them was Pot Shot, which was sort of halfway between Duck Hunt and, like, Hunting an Oregon Trail.
Carnival, right?
Carnival,
Or Carnival. Yeah, it's a shooting gallery game. But so you have like bunnies on the top, which are slow, and then moose, and then ducks, which are fast, and you get various points for them.
I do think of bunnies as faster than moose, but what do I know?
But
small moose.
All right. It's a little slow.
Micro moose.
And then there's a pinball game, which is actually kind of a weird combination of Pong and Breakout. In that you have like these barriers at the top of the screen and you have a paddle at the bottom of the screen, although there's also like drains beside it, like pinballs, so you can lose no
just
matter
like
what.
Every pinball machine has drains on it.
Yeah, so, but you're trying to break through the things and you can get a higher score if you get into the thing behind the things, but if you break them all, then like extra barriers show up. So it's got some weird mechanics going on.
Yep.
It's a little slow, but it's kind of interesting. And then the other one on that cartridge is Doodle, which is really kind of terrible because it's basically Tron Light Cycles, only you're controlling spiders that move very slowly and trying to trap the other spider in your trail, and it's really frustrating and not very good.
Yeah, but I somehow missed out on this, and it sounds like I didn't.
No, you didn't miss a whole lot. I played it because it was what I had for a while before I bought some more games. So it's that kind of thing.
What about Parsec? Would you consider that a ripoff? It's very
Defender-ish.
Without having all the substance.
I didn't actually own that one, but I've gone back and looked at it. Yeah, it looks like Defender, but it's basically just a side-scrolling
shooter. I don't think you rescue people.
You don't rescue people.
You just shoot. So it's more like Gradius.
So there's if you scramble, really.
Yeah, scramble.
There's a few interesting mechanics. Like, there's some sections, apparently, where you have to shoot down all the enemies, and otherwise they just keep wrapping around and coming back. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this fuel mechanic where you can run low on fuel and have to go through a tunnel.
So very scramble.
Yeah.
And it has good good speech synthesis. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things it says? Like, alert, enemy craft advancing, or something like that. Oh, it's a female voice.
That's right. I do remember, yeah.
Alert, enemy craft advancing.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
But cool. I think the thing about it is the way it's drawn, even though it's not actually vector graphics, it's drawn in that style, which makes it look like Defender and all those other vector graphics games. And it has this
Defender wasn't vector either.
Yeah.
It did have that crisp look, like all of Eugene Jarvis's games had that kind of look to yeah. them.
And it has this apparently like kind of randomized background that scrolls past and has weird
It's a good game, though. It's considered one of the best on this, on the platform.
Today on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted, we are joined by actor, producer, director, author. What else can you do, Brian Cranston?
I sweep floors.
You do?
And I load a dishwasher really, really well.
Do you unload it?
Not too many.
Okay.
Too
many. We could give you a job in our
house.
The
talent is loading it, not unloading.
No, the talent is buying the dishes that fit together and not the dishes that I buy that don't fit in the dishwasher.
Well, I could teach you how they can fit.
Okay, Brian, thank you. That's Brian Cranston on Geffen Playhouse Unscripted. Be sure to listen on Podcast One or through the Podcast One app and Apple Podcasts.
Hey, Retronauts listeners, I regret to announce that our current reality is boring. Instead of jumping on the back of a chocobo or into the cockpit of a wondrous airship whenever we want to go down to the local Trader Joe's, we have to rely on cars. Machines made of fiberglass and steel that run on liquefied dinosaur corpses. But if you're in the market for a new ride, consider turning to TrueCar. With TrueCar, you can see what other people in your local market paid for the car you want, information that empowers you to feel confident. Once you register with TrueCar, you can connect with a certified local dealer and see real pricing on actual inventory. And with over 13,000 certified TrueCar dealers nationwide and over 3 million cars sold by TrueCar dealers, you can rest assured that TrueCar has a history of happy customers. So when you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
I think you wanted to talk about Alpiner.
No, that wasn't me. That was someone else.
Was that? Oh, okay.
We all wanted to talk about
Alpiner. There was a weird voice in my head that said we should talk about Alpiner, so we should do that.
We should.
Hear me talk about Alpiner.
Alpiner is awesome. I can talk
Alpiner
about
it. Alpiner was great. It was the first TI-99/4A game I ever played.
It was one of my first,
came,
too.
Like, I have like five copies of it. I don't know why everybody had it. And it's just neat. I mean, you're climbing a mountain, and you're avoiding pumas and falling rocks.
I remember it being incredibly frustrating, but still kind of great.
Like, you missed out on the speech synthesis, too.
I did miss out on the speech synthesis. I just had weird, like, synthesis.
Beware, falling objects. You know, that
but,
kind of
yeah, so you're climbing up these mountains. It has these mountains named after real mountains, Mount Hood and Everest and whatever.
Matterhorn.
It's kind of...
Matterhorn.
Matterhorn, yes. And it's kind of... I mean, in a way, it reminds me of the setup of Ice Climber, just in that... You're continually going up and things are mocking you back down. It doesn't have like
nothing
breaking
like
things.
Ice Climber.
Now, the mechanics are totally different.
Yeah, but it's probably more fun than Ice Climber.
Maybe. Probably.
I don't know how to describe what's special about it. It has this feel to it. Like, it's just really cool. Like, you're on an adventure. I mean, you're climbing a mountain. You're trying to get as tall, you know, as high as you can tall real world mountains.
It's miraculous because how did someone who lived in Lubbock, Texas know what it was like to be on a mountain?
Yeah, they didn't have planes back then and stuff.
I mean, one thing was the graphics seemed really impressive for the time, even if they're pretty basic looking now. But you had these huge sprites, or what looked like sprites, and were probably actually half background with small animated parts. But you had this character that was like, you know,
Oh, yeah.
A quarter of the screen tall. Huge. And you ran into, like, these pumas and these bears that were, like, again, a quarter of the screen wide and, like, yeah, had this little hand swiping out at you. It just, like, it looked really impressive compared to other video games at the time, just to have all these big things to interact with.
Yeah. The trees are graphically detailed, too.
Yeah, it had lots of really detail. Yeah. And it had these risk reward things going on. Like the bear would have like a jewel, like right next to its paw that would give you extra points, but it might smack you and knock you back down the mountain. And that was the frustrating part where every time you ran into things, you'd fall farther and farther back down the mountain. But
I liked the high score thing too, where you could type in your name, how high you got.
You got a high rating.
You compete against yourself, I guess, but
sure.
It showed what the highest mountain you got to. I don't think so. But
no, not,
it was just neat within a play session because it said, you know, binge Everest. You know, if you got to Everest. I don't know if I ever got that far. I think Matterhorn was the first one.
You didn't change your name to Binge Everest. Binge Everest.
Binge Everest. That was my first name.
I also really like the cover art for this game because it's this, like, hapless, like, old-timey mountain climber face-to-face with, like, this 10-foot grizzly
bear. Gigantic grizzly bear.
Just looking back towards the camera, yeah. Like, oh, shit, not again. Yeah.
Like the illustrator.
Not again. This happens all the time.
Apparently. I mean, it does. If you play this game, this happens all the time. You get knocked down the mountain by a grizzly bear.
You do. But it's great. So what else is there?
There's Tunnels of Doom, want to be an expert on, but I didn't really get to play it.
I saw it, but I've looked at it.
I saw the older boys playing it, but I was too young at the time to be allowed to play a D&D game.
So it's this interesting hybrid.
I'm embarrassed because I bought a copy of it about 15 years ago, and I never actually ran it. Hooked up my TI. Wow. It was like in a closet. But it's a cartridge and a disc, and it's a dungeon crawler, right?
Yeah, so it's this hybrid. You've got this first-person dungeon crawling, like, you know, Fantasy Star Wizardry style. But then when you get in a battle, it goes to this tactical turn-based battle screen where you've got these sprites on a grid. So it's like both these things at once, which is cool. Not something that I've really seen anywhere else.
So it's kind of like Pool of Radiance-ish.
I never played any of those old D&D games, so I don't have that point of comparison.
Like the Goldback style, where you kind of have... Yeah. I mean, Ultima did that to a degree.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have that background, so...
I feel like that's kind of forward-thinking for, you know, a
it
game
was,
of this
yeah,
for
the it time. Was really cool. It's like highly regarded.
You go in a closet and be in this
for
different battle
day.
System.
Tunnels of Doom. And what about Chisholm Trail, I think...
I
don't remember what that's
about.
I can't
remember
Chisholm
Trail.
I didn't have that one.
It's weird. We don't know anything about it. Let's get it.
So I want to talk about the one that looks like that I did own, which was Tombstone City.
Yeah, I get those two confused a lot.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're very different games.
Were
they
developed in Texas?
Yeah, they were developed in Texas. But they both have these top-down shooter, grid-based shooter kind of views. I don't know too much about Chisholm Trail, but Tombstone City is this weird hybrid. So it has, so it's top down. There's this section in the middle that's these like tombstones that you can hide out between and out and the rest is open. And there's cactuses and tumbleweeds and the cactuses spawn morgues because it's Tombstone City in the 21st century. So there's aliens trying to take over. I don't know why they're spawned by cactuses.
Cactus morgues.
But you have this.
It's like the Western version of Heianchio Alien.
Kind of that, and there's also this centipede element to it because you shoot.
I have to say that every episode.
Heianchio Alien is a great thing to say.
Yeah,
but so
set a record as the white man who said Heianchio Alien most.
So you shoot these morgue aliens, and they turn into cactuses for some reason. But if you end up with two cactuses in adjacent spaces, they spawn more morgues. So you have to be very careful about where and when you shoot these things.
And morgues are spelled M-O-R-G-S.
M-O-R-G-S.
We're not talking about like a place where they're prepared dead bodies.
This is just a weird name for an alien.
Okay.
So you have to be like strategic about where you shoot these things. And you only get rid of the generators if you shoot them like right as they're generating. But you can also like very easily inadvertently create more generators by shooting them in the wrong place. And you can also like trap yourself in your safety zone by
sounds
blocking
like a really
your exits.
Evil version of Gauntlet.
Yes,
it is. It's like a weird
generator thing.
It's like some Gauntlet and some centipede and a whole bunch of things mashed together, and it's actually kind of cool because there's actually kind of ends up being a bunch of strategy to it. Although then in the end, you know, it's an arcade game and things just get faster until you die. But
that's
like,
just like life.
Yeah.
So someone put on here that there is a Scott Adams Adventure cartridge on the system.
Oh yeah,
that I didn't
tell
know.
Me
it's
about
called
that.
Adventure.
Go ahead.
There's a cartridge called Adventure, and it's like, I think by itself, it either doesn't work or just plays the pirate adventure, like the first Scott Adams adventure. And it's really neat because it's, you know, a single screen graphical adventure, text adventure, where you see a picture and you type in two word commands like get lamp you know, move rug, you know.
Punch Hulk.
Punch
Hulk. I guess it's not one of those Scott Adams games,
though. So is this another one where you can add in?
I think you can load from disc or cassette, different adventures. So it must have the engine or the parser or whatever on the cartridge.
Yeah.
I think that's the way it works.
And Benj, I know you wanted to talk about Music Maker.
Oh, that was, I added that one. I had that.
Ben, sorry.
Yeah,
someone did. Someone's got to get a different name.
Yeah, I know. So that was one I had because I had that.
Just call me Everest from now on.
Everest.
Call me Karen if you want to. But anyways, so Music Maker is basically like the music module of Mario Paint. It's a little graphical tracker. It doesn't have fun icons like Mario Paint. It just has actual notes. But it's basically you use, you know, you can use the joystick if you hate yourself, but you use whatever input method to actually just literally drag and drop notes onto staves. And it's just this cute little tracker. There's nothing too fancy about it, but that was something that, you know, pre having Max and having Mario Paint, that was something that you couldn't really do anywhere else. So it's just cool to have that as a cartridge. You can write your own songs.
There was TI Home Accountant, which was an exciting spreadsheet simulator.
Oh yeah. I loved that game. It was so fun.
Yeah. Did you ever balance your checkbook on it and I never
made it to the final boss.
I'm pretty sure my dad was still balancing our checkbook on the Osborne at this point.
It was neat that there were a lot of application, you know, utilities and stuff on cartridge on the TI. Many more than other platforms, you know, word processors,
How you could write and save your own stuff on this.
Yeah, sure.
So the other thing about TI is it came with TI Basic, which as Bench said was interpreted, so it was incredibly slow, but it was basically a full-featured basic language system, and you could just write your own programs, and then if you had the, like, audio cassette adapter, you could save your code out onto audio cassette and play it in your Walkman if you wanted to hurt your ears with static.
Nobody did that.
No. But yeah, and so they would, and people would also put out these books. So this was a thing that happened in the late 80s, is you could get these whole books of type it in yourself basic programs. And so I had like a space themed one and a monster themed one and a weird stuff themed one. And they were all like super simple things because, you know, 40 lines of basic is about all you're going to want to type in off a page, and that can only get you so much. But they would do cute little things like print out neat patterns or, you know, let you type in your name and put it back to you in a different context and that sort of stuff.
Or like convert Fahrenheit to Celsius.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you could do that.
That was a whole program back then.
Yep.
So are there any other games worth talking about?
Probably.
I see Hangman and Car Wars. I don't know anything about either of those games.
Hangman is this weird, like, rumored to be about a guy with letters and like a...
Is it based
like
on the Led Zeppelin song?
Yeah. Hangman! Yeah, that one.
The one where you can't get silver or gold?
Yeah, you can't get
nothing
that.
To keep you from the Alice Bowl.
Yeah, Jimmy Page shows up and he tries to hang you.
From the era before people started doing ports.
Okay. So there is one thing I want to ask you guys about, and I wasn't able to find much info about this, and I don't know if I just, like, read a site that was completely lying about it, but the MBX.
I have one.
It's, like, it's crazy. Apparently, it was, like, going to be a Milton Bradley game console, and Milton Bradley decided, oh, no, we can't compete. So they turned it into, like, an add-on peripheral for the TI?
Yeah, and I think they approached somebody else first about, like, Atari or something.
This is like the opposite trajectory of the Sony PlayStation.
Yeah, MBX, it's got this weird touchscreen thing that's not a screen. It's a touch panel surface where you can insert overlays, and it has this interesting joystick that's
kind of like
analog.
The Intellivision controller, but bigger?
The what?
The Intellivision controller?
Intellivision? Yeah, kind of. I mean, if you think about slipping an overlay on an Intellivision controller, but it's like the size of... a book, like a textbook or something, you know. And also, there's a big joystick with a trigger button on the front that you hold in your hand. It has like a grip, like a gun, and you have a trigger.
It's like a pistol
and it's got
controller.
Three buttons on the back and an analog joystick that also rotates at the top, like a paddle.
Oh, yeah, like Ikari Warriors in the arcade.
Yeah,
where it was like a stick and then it had the rotating.
Poor man's trackball kind of thing where you just spin.
Yeah, and also there are other earlier consoles that played with that concept.
There was an Atari spin controller.
But the neat thing was the speech recognition, supposedly. It had this headset that didn't have speakers, but just had a microphone, but you put it on over your head like a headset, and you could shout into it and then say, like, you know, move or something. I don't remember.
Was it better than at recognizing your speech than Lifeline for PlayStation 2?
I think it didn't really recognize speech. It just recognized sound and the intensity of the sound. So whatever you shouted, you could just say biscuits or Everest or whatever, and things would happen. And I know there was a cool baseball game for it. I think the reason why I never used it is I have a boxed MBX with all the stuff, but I don't know if I have any cartridges that work with it. And if I did, I haven't set up my TI-99 in a while, other than I did write an article about it for PC World last year. But it was neat. I mean, it's an interesting thing. I think Milton Bradley licensed the controller as the Space Age controller to Atari later in the 80s, but it didn't have the analog and it didn't have the knob or something like that. But it was a similar shape and it looked didn't have as many buttons.
Okay, so that wasn't just something someone made up. It actually did exist.
It's real. I have one.
But it was only sold, according to the site that I read, it was sold for like 2 months.
Yeah.
It was like super, super rare.
So maybe the thing I have is worth something. I have no idea. I should look that up. I bought it, you know, in the 90s or something on eBay. So it's in the box.
Yeah, I looked up
$3,000.
I looked up TI pricing before this episode, and the systems sell for nothing. The computers are cheap.
Yeah.
But add-ons and peripherals are like hundreds and hundreds of dollars. They're extremely expensive.
The peripheral expansion box is highly coveted and rare and hard to get.
It's coveted and rare?
Coveted among computer collectors.
Rare, really?
Rare, yeah. Because it was expensive.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like I said, you know, I've over the years accidentally collected like 5 TI-99/4As in the box. Everybody kept them in the box probably because they just played them and put them back. That's how you know it wasn't very popular. I have a lot of things like that.
The box.
Yeah, and then there's also the later gray versions that after like 83 or something, they did a lower cost model of the TI-99/4A.
I did not know that.
That's plastic, all gray plastic.
Does the audio cassette drive work with anything? Because that's what I've got.
I don't think so. But you could use any cassette drive cassette player with it. Because with
can
that
you
cable.
Just, can you just plug it in on coax or whatever?
Just say, they had three jacks like in, out, the whatever controls the motor on and off kind of thing. Plug. Whatever that's called. So it works with like a Radio Shack cassette drive.
I didn't know it.
So are there any of the later licensed, I guess, games that you guys want to talk about?
Or? I had moved on to Macintosh gaming by that point and Nintendo. So I
just
really
all I know is I have some of those cartridges, like we mentioned earlier. Sega's.
There's a bunch of stuff that exists.
I think there may have only been one Atari Soft port Defender or something. I know I saw there was a rarity list we looked at.
I'm going to read some letters because we actually got more letters about TI than Mac.
Oh,
I was
cool.
Really surprised. Well, people really seem to have
inexpensive
memories. Yeah. So this is from Claybot. In the early 80s, my schoolyard chum Ross had a TI, and around that time, we were playing with doing rudimentary programming of our elementary school's Apple II computer. Ross was fortunate enough to have a TI at his house, so naturally we started trying to figure out how to hack around with the TI. I knew a bit more about the workings of Apple, so I mostly spectated provided design ideas when Ross would mess with the TI programming. I recall trying to make very simplistic choose-your-own-adventure games. My most definite memory of the system was Ross explaining to me that we needed to save our games and programs on a cassette tape, a fact that blew my mind and simultaneously, even at that young age, struck me as a bad way to run software.
Hey, Ross sounds like a cool guy.
From Tom Hewlett, my friend had a TI growing up, and I remember it fondly. The games were better in general than what my family had on Atari, but obviously far below the NES. The same friend would get soon after, instantly relegating his TI library to the garage. Standouts include Parsec, a Gradius-style shooter that required you to navigate a tight corridor to refuel, and Tombstone City, a cool little twist on Centipede where defeated aliens became tombstones that helped shield you from attack but could impede movement.
Yeah.
I'm always curious to revisit these Black Sheep games, but maybe they're better left in my memories, their shortcomings forgotten. If I ever design a space shooter, though, look forward to refueling.
It's okay to like whatever you grew up with. I'm just going to say that.
Oh, here we go. From Jess Reagan. First, I think it's worth mentioning the celebrity endorsements the computers of the early 80s had gotten. William Shatner for the Commodore VIC-20. Mm-hmm. Alan Alda for the Atari XL series.
Stop the podcast.
The late Charlie Chaplin for IBM. And somewhat dubiously, Bill Cosby for the TI-99/4A.
Yeah.
Second, I have to admit that I was a little disappointed in the kinds of games available for the TI-99/4A. Sure, there were plenty of twitchy action titles, but games like The Alien and Chiseled Trail always seemed off. They were a little too slow, a little too stiff, a little too awkwardly designed. What would you have done to improve them? Maybe you...
make them a little more responsive.
That's a question for a certified
computer
game designer.
Yeah. The TI was not a graphics-based system. It was a character-based system, right?
It's a good question.
Essentially,
Al Schreiner
had a bunch of character graphics that were all assembled together like blocks. I don't know how.
It was all built on blocks.
I mean, they could have gotten some great licensed games. I mean, there were some later, but it was probably too late, as we mentioned. You know,
I was just looking up on here.
He's looking at the cartridge.
Yeah, I was just looking up on here, up in 8384. You've got things like Dig Dug and Donkey Kong and stuff showing up.
So it's yesterday's games tomorrow.
Yep.
And finally, one last letter from Jeff Krebsbach. Let's see. Two thoughts on the TI-99/4A. Bill Cosby was 1,000 times cooler as a spokesman than George Plimpton, current events notwithstanding. That speech synthesis box, I haven't heard it in years, and it probably hasn't aged well, but back in the day, it was so cool. Nice shooting, Captain. Oh, and the poor man's Pac-Man. Yeah, Munchman wasn't fooling anyone. Thanks for spending time on the also-ran B-tier consoles. We were young and naive back then, and we didn't know any better.
You're welcome. We should talk about Bill Cosby because how he ruined all of our childhoods and everything. And he was the spokesman.
Yeah,
and I used to love – also, I had like a small cottage industry for years, posting scans of wonderful celebrity endorsements and everything. And now everything I did about Bill Cosby is like
toxic.
Just got to – toxic. Yeah. So yeah. I've had requests from editors to remove him from slideshows and
leave all that behind
us. I don't mind. I mean, he's like a monster. There you go.
Yeah,
I mean he's part of history, but he's that's not good entertainment history. All right, let's cleanse our palate with one last letter. After all, from Kevin Bunch, the TI-99/4A was the first home computer we ever had, albeit briefly. My parents picked it up from an elementary school computer lab that was replacing their TIs with Apple IIs in the late 80s. So naturally, every game we had for it was an educational title.
Mm-hmm.
There were some decent ones too. I have vague memories of some arithmetic and spelling games where you'd get a canned animation for each correct answer. The best was a Centipede-esque basic math game that I admittedly couldn't do much in since this was before I'd learned multiplication and division. We ended up swapping the TI-99/4A for a Commodore 64 after maybe a year, and the rest of my family practically forgot we ever had it. As a first glimpse of the computer age, though, it's left an indelible mark on my memories.
So I actually had one of these incredibly generic math games. I had a cartridge named Addison Wesley Math Game 6, which is about as exciting as it sounds. I'm pretty sure my parents made me get that along.
That's the one with the Russian boxer guy.
This is actually the one with baseball in it, which is weird. It has a baseball game that looks like one of the old NES baseball things, only instead of actually playing baseball, you answer math problems and people run around bases.
Sounds very disappointing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Baseball math. Is that all the letters you got? Five, four?
There was one or two more, but we need to wrap this up.
Okay.
So
yeah.
So we'll call it a day. Any final thoughts on the TI-99/4A?
Alpiner and Tombstone were actually kind of fun. That's about what I can say for it.
It's worth it just to play Alpiner. I'd say get one just to play Alpiner, hear the cool music. It goes dun, 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 dun. It's this famous European.
Oh yeah, a bunch of them all had classical music that it was in the public domain,
like a polka or something. It was neat.
Schnitzelbank.
And the speech synthesis,
synthesis was cool. Even if I didn't have it, I can be jealous of it.
Yeah, it was cool.
All right,
that's all we gotta say.
So I guess that wraps it up for TI-99/4A. We managed to talk about it for 45 minutes, which honestly is a lot more than I thought we were going to get out of this topic. So. Congratulations, us. Thanks, everyone who wrote in. Even though this is a pretty obscure and more or less forgotten system, as Binge said, because the price cuts were so dramatic that it did eventually kind of reach a certain saturation. I think they sold about 3 million units total over time. So yeah, there's pretty good odds. It's like
clunky little system.
1 in 100 chance that someone living in America would have owned one. So, you know, 1% of us, why not? We're the 1%ers.
I am those people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good. These are the good 1%ers.
Yeah, the good ones. The TI-99/4A 1%ers.
Well, we try.
The ones who are willing to pay $49 for a computer.
TI didn't make very good profits on this machine.
No, they didn't.
That division got shut down.
That's why Commodore crushed them. It's kind of sad. But they still make good calculators, so that's great. Anyway, for Retronauts, this has been Jeremy Parrish,
Ben Jedward,
Ben Elgin.
And you can, of course, find Retronauts at Retronauts.com, on iTunes, and on the Podcast One Network. Retronauts continues to be supported through Patreon, patreon.com/retronauts. So please help us out. Keep the lights on. Keep me fed. It's very important. I need to eat. Not a lot. I don't ask for a lot. Just enough to sustain myself.
Gin budget.
Wife. What's that?
The gin budget.
Yeah, I got to feed these guys
gin. Gin budget.
Got to keep them drunk for the podcast.
That's good stuff.
Mm-hmm. On Twitter, you can find me personally as GameSpite. And you can check out my YouTube videos and stuff like that. Whatever you want. Anyway, guys, tell us about yourselves.
BenJedwards.com, VintageComputing.com. You can find me on Twitter at BenJedwards with no space in the middle. And Ben?
I'm still on Twitter at Kirin with two N's. So that's KIRINN on Twitter. And I'm also starting a sort of retro Tumblr where I may post some pictures of my TI and some other stuff that I found in my closets. It's called kirinsretrocloset.tumblr.com. Only one N this time, sorry.
That sounds like an unwieldy URL.
Yeah, well, you know, Tumblr names. You got to come up with something that's not already being used.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. That's fun.
All right, so that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts Micro. Bob will be back in 2 weeks with his own episode of Retronauts Micro. I don't know what it'll be. And there'll be another one from me 2 weeks after that. It's like, you know, bi-weekly cycle or something. Pretty crazy. So thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting us. And enjoy the rest of your day, night, whatever the hell time you're listening to this. Thanks.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.